headlines. Israeli settlers attacked a group of Palestinian olive farmers in the occupied West Bank amid an uptick in settler violence in recent months. British lawmakers pressed for tougher security in the wake of the murder of a second sitting MP in just over 5 years. And in a rare move, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, excludes Myanmar's junta chief from the bloc's upcoming summit.
This is Muse. Thanks for joining us.
A group of Palestinian olive farmers have been attacked by Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian media say the attack took place near the town of Salfit while farmers were harvesting their olive trees. About 30 settlers from a nearby settlement hurled stones and used pepper spray at the farmers. 4 people sustained minor injuries as a result. The media also cited a local farmer saying that the attackers smashed cars and stole olives. Israeli police say that they have arrested 4 settlers in connection with the robbery. Settler violence has seen an uptick in recent months. Last month, dozens of Palestinians were injured after settlers attacked a Bedouin village in the southern West Bank. Earlier, we were joined by our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil, who gave us an update on the Israeli settlers' violence against Palestinian farmers.
Well, here in the occupied West Bank, Palestinian families are used to leave to their lands during the olive harvest season. A Palestinian family from the village of Yasuf, near Salfit, northern the occupied West Bank, were in their own land that is unfortunately very close to an area where the illegal settlement of Rahel is built. While they were there, a group of Israeli settlers, over 30 settlers, came out from the illegal settlement of Rahel in the mountain, and they came down to the Yasuf village, attacked this Palestinian families, and tried to order them to leave the area.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has held a funeral procession for some of the victims of Thursday's attack on a protest rally in Beirut. 7 people were killed and dozens wounded after protesters came under gunfire and bomb attacks. Lebanese authorities have arrested 19 people in connection with the violence. Mariam Saleh reports from Beirut.
Hezbollah held a funeral procession for 3 of the 7 people who were killed by the far-right Lebanese Forces political party led by Samir Jaja. As the families of the victims awaited to bid their loved ones farewell, the slogans were those of grief and pious patience. One of the martyrs, Maryam Farhat, a mother of 5, was shot in the head while she was in the comfort of her own home. Her sister tells Press TV that her blood will protect Lebanon from any sedition.
God bless her soul. She has made us proud. And may God give us and her children patience. I want to tell those that are sowing sedition in the country not to think about it too hard, because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah will not allow it. He is the one safeguarding this country.
Hezbollah officials attended the funeral. The highlight of the event was a speech by head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayyid Hashim Safiyuddin, who directly accused the Lebanese Forces party of being behind the shootings.
The Lebanese Forces Party's acts are aimed at initiating a new civil war in Lebanon. This is not new for us. In the past, we warned against such plots without naming anyone. All the sectarian incitement and provocation in the media was only to drag people to internal fighting. Today, they have uncovered their true faces. Its masters have hurriedly taken this step to drag the country to a civil war.
The master of the killers, he says, is the United States administration.
This is only one episode of the many episodes that are being orchestrated by the United States of America and is funded by some Arab countries. If you go back to the records of the Civil War, they all mention that the U.S. backs and pushes for such acts and Arab states fund it. They are repeating the same episode.
Sayyid Safiyuddin said Hezbollah will not allow anyone to take Lebanon to the misery that the previous generations lived during the time of the civil war, while also calling for justice for the martyrs.
Hezbollah has buried the martyrs who fell in yesterday's shootings, and though the people have chanted that the blood of the innocent will not be in vain, the method of retaliation will not be by taking arms against fellow Lebanese. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has strongly rejected accusations recently leveled against the Islamic Republic by the president of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev. Saif Khatibzadeh said such allegations are in line with the interests of the Israeli regime, which seeks to, quote, affect brotherly relations between Iran and Azerbaijan. He said that Iran has had a leading role in fighting drug trafficking and has sacrificed thousands of lives while dealing with this menace. Khatibzadeh noted that relevant international bodies have time and again confirmed Iran's relentless anti-narcotics campaigns. His comments came in reaction to accusations that Aliyev made during a virtual meeting of the Commonwealth of Independent States. He claimed that Armenia, in collusion with Iran, had been using former occupied territories of Azerbaijan to smuggle illicit drugs to Europe for 30 years. British police have declared the fatal stabbing of Conservative Party's lawmaker David Ames a terrorist incident. The Metropolitan Police say that the early investigation has revealed a potential motivation linked to extremism. A 25-year-old British man of Somali origin was arrested at the crime scene in Leigh-on-Sea town, east of London. Police say that they are not seeking anyone else over the murder. The veteran MP was talking with voters at a church when he was stabbed to death on Friday. Lawmakers are now pressing for tougher security. Home Secretary Priti Patel has ordered police across the country to review security arrangements for all 650 MPs. 69-year-old Ames was the second sitting lawmaker murdered in just over 5 years. Joe Cox of the Labour Party was killed in 2016 while meeting his constituents. Our London correspondent Syed Pourreza says the stabbing death of a British parliamentarian raises questions about security arrangements for government officials in the country.
This is the second murder in nearly 5 years. The last one that happened took the life of Joe Cox, a Labour MP known for speaking up for human rights, for the rights of minorities in the UK. She gave this impassioned speech inside Parliament on the Syria war. She went to bat for Syrian child refugees, spoke up for Muslims and other minorities in the UK, but was brutally murdered in pretty much the same fashion in her constituency in West Yorkshire in 2016, I believe. And that was not the only one. There were other murders before that, one in 2010 and another one in 2001. And what that is really has led to is it has raised questions around the security arrangements around such meetings, which are referred to as surgeries, the meetings between MPs and their constituents. Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, has promised that she would order an immediate review of security arrangements around such meetings. But then the question that's being asked is how plausible that is to provide security detail to these MPs to make them less vulnerable to attacks of such kind.
Youth unemployment rises in the EU, while at the same time employers cannot find skilled workers. The European Commission says major reforms to education systems are essential. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Education is considered a fundamental right in the 27-nation European Union, but questions are being raised around the effectiveness of school curriculums. The number of young people who find themselves without a job in the bloc is growing.
We look for jobs. It's very hard to find, especially in the pandemic, and a lot of people lost their jobs. So it's even harder now to find a job.
What do you think?
I think it's not only about jobs. We didn't go to university for 2 years, and people graduated from home. It's an event of a lifetime, and they didn't get to do it.
Nearly all my friends don't have jobs, and the ones who have are paid an absolute misery, because it's not only the having or not having a job, it's having a decent pay.
EU Jobs Commissioner Nicola Schmidt attended a meeting of EU employment ministers on Friday. During an online press conference following the meeting, we pointed out that youth unemployment was already out of control in several EU nations prior to the pandemic, namely in Greece, Spain, and Italy.
How confident can we be now that solutions can be found after the pandemic when we couldn't really find solutions before the pandemic?
Many sectors are desperately looking for skilled persons, for skilled people, and they do not find them. And this shows us that there are major mismatches on our labor market.
So the Commissioner believes reskilling for the digital age is the answer, but the European Commission has been talking about that now for almost a decade. Economists are saying official EU youth unemployment data at present is misleading. COVID-19 financial supports have been keeping jobs alive, but these government programmes are now being withdrawn. A potential tsunami of job losses is being forecast. The vast majority of those in precarious employment are young adults. Associated mental health issues and homelessness are big concerns. An EU social summit is scheduled for next Wednesday. Civil society organisations say the problems are well known. It's time, they say, to finally find solutions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The number of daily coronavirus deaths in Russia has topped 1,000 for the first time since the start of the pandemic. The new daily figure pushes the overall death toll to more than 222,000, which is the highest in Europe. The country has also reported more than 33,200 new infections in the last 24 hours. Russia has been witnessing a steep rise in COVID cases and related deaths for the past couple of weeks. Officials blame the surge on the more contagious Delta variant and the people's reluctance to get vaccinated. Only 31% of Russians have been fully vaccinated so far. The government has also avoided imposing major restrictions despite the surge. However, some regions have reintroduced QR codes for access to public places. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, has excluded Myanmar's junta chief from the bloc's next week's summit in Brunei. The decision was taken by ASEAN foreign ministers at an emergency meeting on Friday night. They cited rising concerns over the junta's insufficient progress in ending the political turmoil in Myanmar. The statement said that the bloc has rather decided to invite a non-political representative from there. Several countries outside of the bloc, including the U.S., Britain, Canada, and Australia, have welcomed the decision. ASEAN was under international pressure to address the post-coup unrest and crackdown in a Southeast Asian member. According to the UN, more than 1,000 civilians have been killed since the military seized power in Myanmar in February. Multiple bomb explosions have ripped through a Shia mosque in the Afghan city of Kandahar, which occurred on Friday, killing dozens of worshippers. More than 40 are confirmed dead so far, and hospital sources say the toll could rise. Dozens of people are also injured. Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for the attack, in which three back-to-back explosions hit Imam Bargah Mosque during the Friday prayers. Eyewitnesses say that one of the several assailants blew himself up inside the mosque. They say two more attackers detonated their explosive devices in crowded areas outside of the main building. There were reports of gunfire as well.
The United States invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 under the pretext of eliminating Al-Qaeda terrorists who were being supported by the then Taliban government. Washington spent $2 trillion in maintaining its military presence, but at a heavy human cost. Over 6,000 Americans and more than 100,000 Afghans were killed, and millions of others displaced. But the U.S. never achieved its stated goals, rather fled from Afghanistan, leaving the country again in the hands of the Taliban. Now the Taliban are facing a multitude of challenges. One of the main tasks before the group is how to fix the economy, as nearly half of the population is in need of foreign assistance. Humanitarian organizations have already warned that the country is on the brink of collapse. But perhaps a more pressing issue is security. Although Afghanistan has witnessed sectarian violence for decades, deadly incidents have increased since a Daesh terror group emerged in the country at the height of the US military campaign. The Taliban have failed to put an end to such carnages after they rose to power in the war-ravaged country a few months ago. Last Friday, more than 100 worshippers were killed or wounded in a Daesh-claimed attack on a Shia congregation mosque in the northern city of Kunduz. The tragedy struck again on October 15th, this time in Kandahar, where a series of explosions inside a Shia mosque left dozens of worshippers dead. Some analysts believe the United States is trying to sow the seed of sectarian strife, since an unstable Afghanistan serves Washington's interests.
Certainly, there are a number of national interests, both near and afar, that seem almost hell-bent on maintaining a state of insecurity and conflict throughout the Middle East, all the way over, certainly to Afghanistan. Certainly the U.S. Policy going back many years, going back 20 years now at least, has always been to encourage conflict in the region and maintain a state of instability. It suits Israel. It suits a number of other parties.
And it's clear that somebody is trying to provoke a sectarian war between the Shias and the Sunnis. Who's going to benefit from that is, I think, the ultimate question. In Iraq, for example, there's evidence that the British, Americans, and the Israelis were setting off bombs to try to provoke a conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis, so it's easier to control. Perhaps that same tactic is being employed in Afghanistan, where you have British and American agents trying to provoke a civil war to pit the Sunni and the Shia and then to help destabilize the country. And out of that, they might be able to get some sort of control.
No matter who are the perpetrators of sectarian violence in Afghanistan, one thing is for certain. The Taliban, as new rulers, need to ensure security for all ethnic and religious groups. Otherwise, neither the international community nor the Afghan people will ever see them fit to govern, and thus will continue losing their credibility.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few words of advice to eulogists. The 3rd of February, 2021. When some of the people in the camp of the Commander of the Faithful began to curse the army of Muawiyah, he, Imam Ali alayhi salam, asked them to stop it. I dislike you starting to abuse them. This is Fatimi and Alawi behavior. I will tell you that fortunately today, the promotional organizations of the country are moving towards perfection and transcendence. Good tasks are being carried out in deep, intellectual, and scholarly areas in Islamic seminaries. Fortunately, we have witnessed the manifestation and reflection of this in the area of eulogies. In last year's month of Muharram and Ramadan, during which the coronavirus had already spread, we witnessed that you made good moves and presented beautiful works. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah.
The
increase in the Islamic Republic's power of confronting the enemy. I hope that you will continue to have the same performance to promote Islamic teachings and to be more successful on a daily basis, God willing, inshallah. You should know that the enemies will not be able to do a damn thing in confronting the Islamic Republic, as was mentioned by some of our brothers. Thankfully, Islam and the Islamic Republic are gaining more power and strength on a daily basis, both in spiritual and material areas. Of course, there are certain problems, but these problems are ups and downs that will always exist in our social life. Some people are rendering services and some are losing opportunities, but overall, our movement is progressing, God willing. I ask Allah the Exalted to bestow success on you. I will pray for you, and I ask the Imam of the Age, may our souls be sacrificed for his sake, to pray for you, as his prayers will surely be answered. I hope that you too will pray for me, and I hope that Allah the Exalted will make the immaculate soul of our magnanimous Imam and the pure souls of our great martyrs satisfied and pleased with us. Greetings be upon you, and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Military coups are yet again becoming a common occurrence in Africa. After recent military takeovers in Mali, Chad, and Guinea, it was the turn of Sudan. Last September, a group of Sudanese army officers purportedly loyal to deposed President Omar al-Bashir led a failed military coup. Now, this is how the national TV announced the unsuccessful coup. Welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an alternative view on events taking place in Africa. Today, we are focusing on the alleged military coup in Sudan and the political and economic crisis in this country, which has also abandoned its long-term support for the Palestinian resistance. In today's show, we shall also look at how employees of the World Health Organization have been involved in sexual abuse in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us till the end of our show and let us know what you think by posting your comments on our social media pages.
Sudan's coup attempt and transition woes. Sudan's fragile transitional government says it foiled an attempted coup that was linked to the ousted regime of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir. Following the coup, political leaders and army generals, who have always been at loggerheads, have now made their differences public for the first time since signing a power-sharing deal 2 years ago.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok further claimed that the coup attempt sought to target the revolution's achievement, stressing that it was orchestrated by Paris from within and outside the Sudanese army. He said it was necessary to reform security institutions after the coup.
The failed coup attempt clearly indicates that it's necessary to reform the military and security apparatuses. It calls for an all-out reconsideration of the transition process and the necessity to forge a partnership based on the values and principles of the revolution towards a civil, democratic transition only.
Well, for an incisive analysis on the coup attempt in Sudan, we have contacted Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He has traveled extensively in Africa conducting field research on political economy. Thanks a lot for your time, sir. Now, first, tell us what, in your opinion, was the reason behind the recent coup in Sudan?
Well, according to the government, they were people who were loyal to the former regime of President Bashir. There's questions about who was actually involved. They claim that 21 people were arrested in a plot to overthrow the government and perhaps reinstall President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. It's still not clear exactly the dynamics of the attempted coup. They claim it was centered in Abdurrahman, which is a twin city of Khartoum. So it looks like it was a power struggle, perhaps within the military apparatus of Sudan.
Well, some sources in Khartoum claim the recent failed coup, just like other reported attempts, had been fabricated by the current military rulers to win the sympathy of Western countries. Mr. Azikiwe, there have been unconfirmed reports that the recent coup in Sudan was actually fake and was planned by the military itself. Do you agree with this viewpoint?
No, I think there are definite differences within the military and also within the political apparatus that are part of the Sovereign Council, the Transitional Sovereign Council. I believe that there are sharp disagreements over fundamental issues involving the composition of a potential legislative council, the question of Sudanese relations with the United States, relations with the State of Israel, and also its relationship with some of the states that are heavily allied with the United States and Israel.
Mr. Abayomi Azikiwe of the Pan-African Newswire. Stay tuned for more.
Bitter recriminations followed the attempted military takeover in September. The facade of unity presented by both the civilian and military members of the Transitional Council has been wiped out. This has now thrown the future of Sudan's transition into deep uncertainty. Mohamed Al-Faqi Suleiman, committee leader and member of the Joint Military-Civilian Sovereign Council, Sudan's highest authority, asked people to be prepared to return to street protests if necessary.
We will defend our government, our people, and the democratic transition to the last drop of blood. And if there is any threat to the democratic transition, we will fill the streets and be at the forefront, as is our responsibility.
Is there a possibility that the current tensions might derail Sudan's transition to civilian rule and plunge the country into more chaos?
It could. They are not able to bring about a stable transitional dispensation. There's been no real date set for multi-party elections throughout the country. The government seems to be more preoccupied with pleasing Washington and Tel Aviv rather than actually looking out for the well-being of the nearly 60 million people that live in the Republic of Sudan. So they have to be concerned about the economic growth of the country. They have to be concerned about bringing a myriad of political parties and mass organizations, civil society organizations, into the political fold inside the country. They've been negotiating with these various rebel groups from Darfur and from the border areas. Some of them have committed to a political dispensation, and others have not. So it's going to be a struggle going forward in order to achieve real stability in Sudan.
The people of Sudan have suffered immensely following their country's separation from South Sudan. The armed insurrections in several parts of Sudan, especially South Kordofan, Darfur, and Blue Nile, have their roots in the decades of conflict between the Khartoum government and the southern regions, which ultimately led to the secession of South Sudan in 2011. The situation in the country is now getting worse since the overthrow of Omar al-Bashir in 2019.
Sudan has seen increased protests by angry masses over poor economic and political conditions. What's really happening in Sudan right now?
Perhaps it is the inability of the Transitional Sovereign Council to meet the needs of the Sudanese people. They have to, in fact, resolve these issues politically. They tried to link the protests in the eastern part of the country to the attempted coup that took place several weeks ago. Whether or not there's a direct link remains to be uncovered, but these are some of the dynamics that the Transitional Sovereign Council has to deal with. The interim Prime Minister, Abdallah Hamdok, is really at the mercy not only of the military in Sudan, but also the international forces of imperialism, which are dictating to him what his policy should be inside his own country.
Now, Western countries condemned the failed coup attempt in Sudan, expressing support for the transitional government, which is increasingly unpopular among the masses in the country.
We were expecting a speedy transition to civilian rule. We don't actually feel there is a transition to anything here yet. Today, there is no freedom, peace, or justice in Sudan.
Now, Mr. Azikiwe, do you think foreign powers are involved in the current political crisis in Sudan, especially by backing a regime which appears quite unpopular among the masses?
No question about it. The United States pressured Sudan under the previous government of President Donald Trump to normalize relations with Israel. They also required that they pay millions and millions of dollars in restitution for terrorist acts that were carried out. And there's no direct evidence that the previous Sudanese government was even involved in these acts. The bombing of the USS Cole in 2000, the bombing in 1998 of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Yet, they made that a precondition of delisting Sudan as a state sponsor of terrorism. So this is an ongoing process. And even to date, despite all these measures that have been taken by interim Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, the country is still suffering from food shortages, fuel shortages, high unemployment, and impoverishment.
Amid growing ties between the Khartoum Transitional Authority and the Israeli regime, Sudan's military rulers have confiscated and taken control of all assets that they claim to have provided backing for the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas on its soil. In response to the report, Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri rejected the claims of the Palestinian Resistance Movement's investment in Sudan. Why have the authorities in Sudan decided to take action against Hamas at this point in time?
According to sources inside of the Sudanese interim government, they were given a list by the United States of companies and organizations and institutions to close down and to seize their assets. And that's exactly what they have been doing over the last several months. They have shut down the it's the resistance movement, Hamas, and they have seized assets which they claim belong to Hamas. But this is something, too, that's been engineered by Washington and Tel Aviv.
The normalization agreement between Khartoum and the Israeli regime provoked a furious backlash from the people in Sudan. Masses in Sudan have slammed as treacherous any ties with the Israeli regime. A resident of Khartoum here says normalization with Israel does not serve the interests of Sudan.
بناسي بالسودانيين بالناس اللي فيها ممكن يختموا ونبقى أحسن من إسرائيل ونبقى أحسن من أمريكا ونبقى أحسن من الناس كلها لو تكاتفنا وخطينا يدنا مع بعض.
Now our last question to you. Clearly, the move by the regime in Sudan to seize Hamas-linked companies is a betrayal of the people of Palestine. What's your take on this?
It is a betrayal. Historically, the Republic of Sudan has been a close ally and supporter of the Palestinian Liberation Movement. In 1958, they passed the Israeli Boycott Act, which prohibited relations and economic interrelationships with the State of Israel. And now they have reversed this entire process. And it's been done largely through the interim government. There's been demonstrations in the country. A number of political parties have signed statements in opposition to this normalization with Israel. And I think it's going to increase, the opposition is going to increase, as the impact of these policies become clear to the Sudanese people.
Well, thanks a lot, Mr. Azikiwe, for your incisive analysis. Here at Africa Today, we shall keep you posted on the unfolding events in Sudan. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is about a sex abuse scandal facing World Health Organization workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us.
WHO scandal in the DRC.
Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
An independent investigation commissioned by the World Health Organization has identified more than 80 alleged cases of sexual abuse during the Global Health Agency's response to an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, the scandal has implicated at least 20 WHO staff members.
WHO staff knew of the allegations in early May 2019, but it wasn't until October 2020 that an independent commission was established. Although the commission was established in October 2020, it took investigators nearly 7 months to start interviews in Congo, where Ebola killed some 2,300 people in Ituri and North Kivu provinces between August 2018 and June 2020, the second deadliest outbreak ever.
Speaking during a media briefing by the independent commission that probed the scandal, WHO Director General apologized the victims.
The first thing I want to say is to the victims and survivors of the sexual exploitation and abuse described in the Commission's report. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what was done to you by people who were employed by WHO to serve and protect you. I'm sorry for the ongoing suffering that this event must cause. I'm sorry that you have had to relieve them in talking to the Commission about your experiences. Thank you for your courage in doing so. What happened to you should never happen to anyone. It is inexcusable.
Now to discuss the abuse scandal facing WHO employees in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have contacted Edward Corrigan, an international human rights lawyer. Thanks a lot for your time. Now, our first question, what really went wrong and how was it possible that WHO staff abused people they were supposed to actually serve?
The problem is that it's a power imbalance. The people control the resources of almost unlimited power, and then you have women that are in a desperate social situation, many of them starving, and they would do anything to get jobs or to get food or even, as one lady said, to get a basin of water just to clean herself. So that power imbalance is the root cause of the problem, and there weren't safeguards in place. The World Health Organization did have some training programs, but only a small percentage of people that were hired undertook the training.
Now, although the Commission recommended that reparations be considered for the victims, that's unlikely to happen in the UN system. The co-chair of the Independent Commission urged the WHO to consider compensating the victims.
Victims for the first reports of incidents until the completion of preliminary investigations. And finally, to also mandate this working group to reflect and make proposals on the possibilities of granting reparations to the victims at the end of duly initiated investigations, starting with the conclusions of the independent commissions in this case.
Now, Mr. Corrigan, do you think the WHO will act on recommendations of reparations or compensation to the victims of the abuse scandal?
I have seen no information to say that the WHO is going to pay reparations or compensation to the victims. However, I think this is something that they should do at a minimum in order to ameliorate the situation and to help these people overcome what had to be a traumatic experience. So I hope the WHO does provide compensation to the victims, because they're at fault because they did not properly screen the workers and they did not put training sessions in place and they did not protect their own employees and people that were volunteering or working with the WHO, and that is grounds for that they should pay for some sort of reparations and compensation.
The abuse scandal in the DRC raises serious questions about the WHO's top leaders and why they were unaware of the extent of the problem. The WHO Director General, for example, visited Congo 14 times during the Ebola response, while other staff made even more visits. This abuse scandal clearly points to deep flaws in international humanitarian operations. The WHO Director General has also admitted that the organization needs to regain the trust which has been dented by the Congo abuse scandal.
And ensure more effective human resources processes. Already, we have taken several steps to improve our HR practices in recruitment, onboarding, induction, and training. We will also take steps to integrate standards of behavior relating to sexual exploitation and abuse in performance management, starting with leaders and managers.
How have these cases of sexual abuse affected the credibility of the WHO in the DRC and across the world in general?
This is definitely going to hurt them, and it also, I think, hurts some of the other organizations, including work from the United Nations and peacekeeping forces, and people should be aware that this problem is unfortunately quite common when you have such a power imbalance between the people who control resources and demand sex and those who are desperate to get some sort of employment, even food, water, whatever. and this is not going to help the WHO, but as I said, you know, World Vision, UNICEF, other medical organizations, and certainly peacekeeping operations have experienced the same problem, and they should be aware of this, and they should take measures to safeguard the women and young girls and anybody else who is subject to exploitation and abuse.
The Investigating Commission recommended that WHO imposes disciplinary action on those who fail to report potential sexual exploitation and abuse incidents. Now, Mr. Corrigan, what other measures should WHO take to prevent such incidents from recurring in future?
Well, they have to send a strong message that if you rape people or you abuse your position, that you're going to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. They also should have proper training sessions in place for people so that they're aware of these rules and regulations, and that they have to be sensitive to respecting the people that are working with them. And the WHO should have some sort of supervisory role and inspecting people, and also notify that if somebody is trying to exploit you or abuse you, that you should report this to the people who are running the operation so that they can take strong measures. The WHO tried to avoid these problems and get caught up in bureaucratic delays, and they also were overly concerned about whether or not these reports are in writing, that they're true. But they were trying to avoid dealing with this issue head on, but now that it's become public and they should be aware, this is unfortunately not an uncommon problem, and they should take strong measures to prevent it from ever happening again.
Thanks, Mr. Corrigan, for your input. We do hope that serious action will be taken to stop these wanton abuse of African people by these so-called international aid workers. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Don't forget to drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know what you think about today's topics. God bless you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio with a smiling face, we have Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
What I would like to ask to both of you is actually a question that's been on my mind, and I'm sure it's on a lot of people's minds. We spoke previously about the resistance front in terms of the media, Press TV and Al-Masira and Al-Alam. These are predominantly projecting the idea of the Islamic Revolution and revolutionary ideals. However, there were other channels as well which, at least apparently, they didn't have anything to do with the revolution. There were other channels as well which didn't seem to be projecting as much the revolutionary ethos, and yet they were blocked. It does feel like a calculated attack against Shiaism collectively. So why is my question, actually? And I'd like to go to whoever. I think I'll go to Sayyid Mahdi first.
Yeah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So here, just a little bit of a quick background. These are 33 channels in total which have been blocked. They have been censored, or in these very, you know, lame terms, they're calling it a seizure, so that it doesn't sound like censorship, but it is really, it is the censorship of free speech and the censorship of media. It is the censorship of ideas. There are 33 total channels that have been censored, that have been seized, they have been blocked, which include channels which are related to Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani. It includes a Bahraini channel, which is an opposition channel based in for Bahrain. It includes, of course, Press TV. It includes Arabic language. Now, Press TV is news. Al-Alam is news. Al-Masira is also news, which is from Yemen. And then there's, like I said, there's a total of 33. So what's interesting is you find that a lot of these are news channels. Press TV, you can't really call it a Shia channel. Al-Alam is not a Shia channel. Al-Masira is not necessarily.
They're news channels, right?
They're news channels. Like, they're just like, it's like if tomorrow the, I don't know, the Chinese Communist Party wanted to block CNN and BBC and RT and Associated Press. I mean, the world would go wild. They would say, who has given you the right to block a news channel, you know? So this kind of censorship, first of all, we talked in a previous program.
If you allow me, there's a common denominator,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And that common denominator is that any channel who is one way or the other, loosely or strictly tied to, or in their calculation, in their research, their means, you know, FBI and the Homeland Security and so on and so forth, if in their calculation it's tied to the Islamic Republic of Iran, they get to pay the penalty, right? They are going to be blocked. That's a clear message that they send out by blocking some of those channels which are not so pro-revolution and so on and so forth. They wanted to give a clear message that if you even think of going down that route, you're going to be blocked.
I have a follow-up question.
So, for example, now where is this coming from? One of the things that we talked in a previous program was this: that they are vulnerable, right? They're vulnerable. They feel fragile.
The West does.
This is why they did this very radical and extreme thing, you know? And they're vulnerable because they have realized that they're weak, right? You don't feel vulnerable if you feel that you're strong. Mm-hmm.
And they feel weak because their narrative is weak.
Their narrative is weak, and that's what's happening, is all of a sudden the Western world can no longer defend their ideals, you know, in this so-called offense. Really, it's a defense of this you know, non-mass mass media, this mainstream mass media, right? So whether it's Press TV or Al-Masira or these guys, they are no longer able to defend themselves. They are no longer able to, the Western media is no longer able to promote the falsehood and really protect the falsehood that is coming out with, when it is faced with the truth and this alternate media that's coming out with these things. And they're afraid that the reality will come out. My final thing here is that this seizure and this censorship of these media outlets is in fact a colossal and manifest admittance of the failure of not just Western media, but their whole system and their whole propaganda empire. And it's interesting, with ending with Sayyid Imam Ali Khamenei, right, the leader of the Muslim Ummah, he says that the Western Zionist media empire can be defeated, and this is what you're seeing, the present day defeat of the Western media empire. Don't let the seizure of a few media channels make you believe that they are in control.
There is something very beautiful and benign about the revolution, and anybody who has the Islamic revolution inculcated into their own ethos, whether to a lesser or greater extent.
Right.
And one of the aspects of that is this idea of unity, which everybody on an Islamic level or a non-Islamic level, just humanity, can understand the importance, the beauty of the concept of unity. In our context, we often talk about this in terms of the Sunni Shia schools of thought within Islam. There's at least one channel on that list that I know of which not only did not adhere to the revolutionary standards, it also went against the idea of unity. And so if I was the enemy, just trying to put myself into the Western imperialists' shoes for a moment, it would make more sense to block all those associated to the revolution and leave the rest. Why have they blocked those as well?
Well, like I pointed out before, that sometimes, you know, you want to give a stronger message to your opposition, right? So what you do is you go that extra mile as well, right? So there are some other Shia, quote-unquote, media outlets that have not been blocked. And some of them are allegedly on the payroll of MI6, mm-hmm. right? And we know that. Some others, you know, they were, I feel, one of the dimensions that I can think of is that it's a clear message. You want to be wearing, you know, the libas and the dress of Prophet. You want to be representing Shia Islam. This is a message to everyone who wants to do this. Don't even dare to affiliate yourselves with Iran. So this is like a preemptive sort of a thing. You give a message. Because sometimes when somebody decides that I'm going to do this, I'm going to be part of the resistance bloc, it's already too late for you to give them a message. Right? By blocking these channels, you do a preemptive. You take a mm-hmm. preemptive strike. So those who are maybe thinking that, okay, let's change the direction because the tide is changing in support of the camp of resistance overall. So let's kind of, you know, squeeze in. Up until now, we have not. Maybe there were those plans. And because of those plans, they had to pay the price, or it was a preemptive.
And to add here, because if you read a few of these articles, it's interesting. The amount of, right, the Mossad has this statement where they say, through deception, we will conquer, or something like that. They have a certain motto that's like that, right? Meaning that one of their main tactics is smoke and mirrors, deception, falsehood, lies, you know, all this kind of crazy stuff. And so here you will find certain news outlets saying that this inclusion of non-revolutionary websites was somehow a mistake committed by the Justice Department, and they didn't do their research. I mean, come on, you have to be like totally naive to believe that a system that spends millions and millions of dollars on research and analysis, and they know who is doing what, right? There is a reason, and the reason which, you know, Sheikh Ali brought up for it, there is a reason why they have included these non-revolutionary websites, as
and
he
off,
said,
off
ascending
top of
a strong.
My mind,
they're doing it on purpose.
Another, yeah, there's another dimension to it. It could be that they wanted them to do certain things, let's say, and they denied, because those platforms are primarily running out of UK, if you notice,
mm-hmm.
the ones we're talking about, right? They denied, maybe. They're like, we don't want to get into this, right? So maybe they're getting punished. We don't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing could be that they may unblock them and unseize them. This seizure is going to be lifted
mm-hmm.
As a result of some sort of a deal that they crack in future, maybe in a week or 10 days or 2 weeks. I don't know. Just saying that when you come to politics and when you